Today on the 21st Show, President Donald Trump is back in the White House and began his administration with a blizzard of executive orders and actions, covering issues including immigration and asylum, pardoning or commuting the sentences of people convicted of attacking the Capitol building in 2021, and even changing the name of a mountain in Alaska.
From this day forward, our country will flourish and be respected again all over the world. We will be the envy of every nation, and we will not allow ourselves to be taken advantage of any longer.
We'll try to put all this in context with a historian and a political scientist and hear how our fellow Illinoisans are taking it in. You can join us, too, by calling 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. 4 years after an unprecedented transition of power that followed months of election denial and an attack on the U.S. Capitol, Donald J. Trump is once again President of the United States. He's the second president in American history to serve non-consecutive terms and the first convicted felon to hold that office after being found guilty by a jury in New York that he had concealed payments to Stormy Daniels in violation of election laws. The transition of power from now former President Joe Biden to President Trump was more peaceful than in 2021, but Trump, in his inaugural address, moved quickly to partisan rhetoric.
My recent election is a mandate to completely and totally reverse a horrible betrayal and all of these many betrayals that have taken place, and to give the people back their faith, their wealth, their democracy, and indeed their freedom. From this moment on, America's decline is over.
Then, in his first hours as president again, and in front of a crowd of thousands, Trump signed executive orders directing U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement and freezing hiring in the federal government. He's also started the process of withdrawing the U.S. from the World Health Organization. He pardoned January 6th insurrectionists, and he made moves to get around the U.S. Constitution's guarantee of birthright citizenship. We asked members of our texting group about this presidential transition. After Trump's inauguration, Kate in Nokomis said, "His speech was terrifying and hateful. I'm feeling worse now than before, and I'm completely fearful of what he and his hate-mongering, racist, misogynist cronies will do." But Sam in Springfield texted us to say, "We might finally get the truth about the JFK assassination and UFOs. Also improved health care under RFK Jr. going after Big Pharma and those putting toxins and other unhealthy substances in our processed foods." Today we're talking about Trump's first day back in office, how it's being received in Illinois, and putting the presidency of Joe Biden into perspective. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-222-9455. How different do you expect Trump's second term to be from his first? What is the legacy of now former President Joe Biden? And how do you feel about Trump's speech yesterday and his actions of the past day? The number again, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Joining me now to talk about this is Matthew Dalek, professor of political management and a political historian at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management. He's written several books. His most recent is Birchers, How the John Birch Society Radicalized the American Right. Dr. Dalek, thanks for making the time. Welcome to the 21st Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Timothy Lewis, an associate professor of political science at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. He's also chair in the Department of Social Work there. Dr. Lewis, welcome back to the 21st Show to you.
Thank you, and I'm glad to be back.
So, Tim, I'm going to start with you. What's going through your mind 24 hours since the swearing-in yesterday?
Honestly, it seems longer than 24 hours. And that is what is going through my mind. There have been a significant amount of changes that do not follow conventional political norms when it comes to the Trump presidency. The rollout of immense executive orders, the shutting down of government apps, The dismissal of government websites, all of these things happening in such a short amount of time, makes the last 24 hours seem much longer than it really is.
It's interesting because I've read so much about this, and you're mentioning one point in there at least that I had not read about yet. So I guess that's just a statement on how much has been happening. Matt, sort of same question to you. What did the mood seem like to you as this inauguration played out?
Well, my reaction is head spinning. Head spinning, though, by design. I think that, this is the message that Trump and his team have wanted to send. It's nearly impossible, as Dr. Lewis, as you just mentioned, to track everything that they have changed in the last 24 hours. Some of the executive orders and actions have been sweeping. So, pardoning 1,600 convicted rioters from January 6th, trying to end the constitutional right of birthright citizenship. And then there are kind of smaller, yet also still significant acts. And so, I've also described it as a kind of shock and awe executive order campaign. And if we just, compare it to prior administrations in the modern era, on the first day of taking office, definitely Trump, there's more action with Trump. And in fact, often, presidents like Barack Obama or Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, maybe they signed one or two executive orders on day one. And so this is, this is a kind of shock and awe effort. And, we're still sifting through it.
In 2017, Trump mentioned American carnage, and that's how that speech has often been shorthanded. At the time, former President George W. Bush reportedly said, quote, "That was some weird bleep." Matt, how would you describe the tone of his speech this year?
Well, American carnage is extremely memorable. I don't think that there's an equivalent standout line from Trump's inaugural speech. And remember, too, he also gave a speech after his formal inaugural address and the night before. They've all kind of blended together. But I think the tone, I mean, some people have said, oh, the tone's a little more optimistic. But I think it's a similarly dark vision. There's a kind of apocalyptic strain that ran through the American Carnage speech. And in this most recent second inaugural address, I think this idea of betrayal, right? That the establishment, institutions, the people running the country for decades, other than I guess for Trump's 4 years in office previously, that they've all betrayed the country. And there's a point, it's like a poignantly dark vision that I think Trump paints. And then there's a grandiosity as well, because his argument is that all of it changes now, and we are going to become the historic, greatest. He uses these really over the top adjectives. And so in that sense, it felt familiar to, I think, what we have seen over the past decade, even though the issues he's tackling are somewhat different and in a different context.
And Tim Lewis, beyond the speech itself, one of the things that people have been remarking on about that ceremony yesterday is who had sort of places of prominence. A lot of billionaires, right? The CEO of Facebook, Meta, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos from Amazon, Sundar Pichai from Google, Tim Cook from Apple. They were seated in front of his cabinet and had prominent, visible positions that usually go to other elected officials. What do you think this signifies in the coming years of the Trump administration that these non-elected CEOs could have?
I think it symbolizes the priority of the Trump administration and how they will navigate the next 4 years. These normally, when presidents want to send certain messages, they will have more, we will say, common people in somewhere in the audience, a poet, an artist, someone who speaks to the average life of the day-to-day American, not people who are so far removed by their income and their experiences that they cannot relate to the common person. And I think this is going to characterize the Trump presidency. It will be characterized by billionaires who are so far removed from the actual experiences and who will take priority over the established institutions and structures of our country. That's a dangerous pathway for the fact that you forget about the constituents who elected you. And I think that's part of the past 24, 48 hours. That were individuals who came to the Trump inauguration expecting it to be outside and paid tickets and made travel accommodations. And all of a sudden they were left high and dry with no refund to the expenses that they had put forth. That type of forgetting of the average citizen, I think, is going to be repeated throughout the Trump presidency.
Matt Dalek, it strikes me that there have always been big moneyed interests closely aligned with certain political administrations, some more than others. Is this different in degree or approach, or how are you thinking about it in that historic context?
It does feel different. It feels a bit more like a reversion to, I don't know, a pre-New Deal era in which, because you're right, of course, there's always been big money, large corporate interests that have spent on campaigns that have been associated with presidents. But this, the prominence of these folks, their really position of honor in a coveted inaugural seats, it gives them a kind of a sense that these are not just the richest people in the world, but they have now total access to power and to the most powerful government in the world. And the whole, I think, idea of the modern American state, at least since the New Deal, has been that there's some separation, right? Even though we know, okay, the rich have more influence, right? Big pharma, for example, has lobbying groups and the like, but that, government, even under Republican administrations, would have some kind of distance between the business sector and the business of government, the business of the public. That line, to the extent that it maybe existed, feels more blurry than ever. And I agree that it's a very worrisome development. The other paradox, though, or the other interesting thing is that, Trump won election because essentially he won and put together a coalition, but primarily driven by working class, non-college educated voters, people at the kind of middle and lower income end of the spectrum. And yet, here he is, sort of giving Elon Musk a prime office, apparently, in the White House, in the West Wing of the Oval, the West Wing of the White House. So that paradox, right? Is the government going to be working to promote Elon Musk's and Mark Zuckerberg's businesses, or is it going to actually get cost of living under control, inflation down? Is it going to help people afford health care? That, I think, is one of the central, if not maybe the central tension in the Trump administration or the Trump years ahead of us. And I think the answer to that will be really important in terms of how Trump does, where how he fares.
Worth noting, I think, as well, that Musk is getting this sort of privilege, the privileges of working in the White House without the obligations that typically come with government employment and disclosures and divestiture of investments and that sort of thing. He also generated controversy yesterday, and I should say we need to take a break in a couple of minutes, but at this post-inauguration rally for President Trump at Capital One Arena in Washington, we have a clip of that. Let's listen.
This one really matters. And I just want to say thank you for making it happen. Thank you. My heart goes out to you. It is thanks to you that the future of civilization is assured.
So you can kind of hear that little slap sound there. So it wasn't so much what he said, but a gesture he made while thanking Trump supporters. He put his hand over his heart, then thrust his hand out up, palm facing down, a one-arm salute, turned around, did it a second time. You know, some said it was odd looking. It sure did look in some ways like the salutes the Nazis used. Matt, what did you make of that?
Well, you know, at first, you know, you look at the image and it's devoid of context and you think, yeah, you know, it looks like a Nazi salute. You know, look, it's very disturbing. I mean, you know, it's not just the salute, whether he intended it as a Nazi salute or not, but, you know, Musk now has a very well documented record of championing really far right figures, especially in Europe, but also in the United States. He has promoted the AFD party, which is a kind of a far right party in Nazi Germany. He's championed individuals who, for example, have been accused and I think even convicted of, you know, a racist a speech in Europe. And he's also spread conspiracy theories that are also rooted in a kind of racist worldview about, you know, the great replacement theory, for example, that immigrants are coming to replace white Americans and by voting in mass for Democrats.
All right. We're going to need to take a break. We will be able to continue this conversation when we return. If you want to join us today, we'd love to hear from you. 800-222-9455. It's been quite a 24 hours. How are you thinking about it? Maybe you're excited. Let us know. 800-222-9455. This is the 21st show. Stay with us. This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the first 24 hours of the second Trump administration, how they've played out from his inauguration to his first actions in office. A little later, we'll reflect on the legacy of now former President Joe Biden and the political moment we are in. My guests for this are Timothy Lewis, professor at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville, and Matthew Dalek, a political historian and professor at George Washington University. You can join us at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Before the break, we were talking about Elon Musk, who arguably, I would argue, is probably the most powerful non-elected citizen in America right now, perhaps even the world. At least that's his ambitions. Yesterday at a post-inaugural rally, he gave this one-arm salute. Friend of the show Brendan Moore was covering J.B. Pritzker yesterday and posted online that Pritzker explicitly called what Musk did a Sieg Heil or Nazi salute. He said it was disgusting. He says President Trump should call it out and Musk should apologize. Again, I don't want this to be, and this is one of the things we're going to have to balance in the next 4 years, is what are the substantive things to talk about? What are the distractions? But boy, that was sure a moment. Tim, how did you react to that? What did you see there?
If I am honest, I agree with Governor Pritzker. To me, that was clearly a Nazi salute. Even if it was not, and it was just, you know, Musk getting caught up in the moment. As a person who is that visible in the public eye, a billionaire worldwide known, will have an unelected position in the next administration, he should be culturally aware that just certain gestures without intent are still offensive. There are literally more than 7 million people in the United States who identify as Jewish and have a direct link to being survivors or having an ancestor to those who survived from the atrocities of the Holocaust, and must should be culturally aware that gestures have meanings, symbols have meanings, and he should not have done that. So whether he intended it to be a Nazi salute or not, to me, is irrelevant. Images matter, and he should apologize.
Matt, there's so much that happened in the last 24 hours and that will continue happening, from immigration, right? Potentially trying to end birthright citizenship. That's outlined in the U.S. Constitution. That's sure to face a court challenge. Ending a program that allows migrants to enter the U.S. as legal asylum seekers. Taking aim at diversity programs, rolling back protections for LGBTQ people, trans people in particular, saying the government only recognizes two sexes. And then we haven't even gotten into the stuff about renaming the Gulf of Mexico, the Gulf of America, or at least part of it. I think that's worth noting. We can get into the details of that. But Matt, maybe this is just a good time to sort of step back and say, how are you approaching your focus and your attention in the days, months, and years ahead, right? Some of these things are matters of life and death. Others seem like punchlines that could have been dreamed up by the writer's room at SNL. So how do you keep your eye on the ball?
Yeah, well, and I think you make a great point that it's almost impossible to separate out the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. For me, I think what I'm struck by most are at least a couple of things. One is that he pardoned not just people convicted of nonviolent offenses on January 6th, but also the violent offenders, people who beat police officers, leaders of the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers are now out of jail, convicted of seditious conspiracy. You know, he really took a maximalist approach. And, you know, that wasn't a given. That, I think, is a massive step that will also have long-term, all kinds of long-term implications. A second piece, which, you know, we knew to expect, but the scope of it is still, I think, somewhat breathtaking to see in reality, which is on immigration. And whether it's the closing of the app for people to request appointments to enter the United States, ending birthright citizenship, you know, from start to finish, and watching for mass deportations, because immigration is really central to Trump's movement. And then the last piece that I'm watching and is interesting are the tariffs. And part of the reason I say that is because Trump in some ways has defined himself by being anti-free trade, being very pro-tariff, especially in this last campaign. And then, of course, his anti-immigrant stance as well. And so he's proposing, he says very quickly, he's going to put big tariffs on Canada and Mexico. Maybe there'll be other countries to follow. That has implications for the economy. So to me, there are obviously a lot of other issues that are really important, but those are kind of the top line ones that stand out.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm reminded of trying to follow all this. There's a line from Kevin Kelly, the great sort of thinker on the internet. He's the founder of Wired magazine. He has this aphorism: you don't have to attend every argument you are invited to. And I think that's something we're going to have to keep in mind in the next few years. Tim, let's get into the immigration stuff a little bit. I know this is something I think we've talked about in the past, but I mentioned the end of birthright citizenship, which again is outlined in the U.S. Constitution. That's certainly going to be challenged in court. His administration ended this program that allowed migrants to enter the U.S. as legal asylum seekers. And there's been reporting that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the federal ICE agency, is preparing for raids targeting immigrants in Chicago, possibly as early as today, although there have been conflicting reports on the timeline. Tim, what are your first impressions of the effects these actions that the new administration is taking?
These actions should be jarring to legal citizens in the United States. And let me tell you why. The closing of that app is bigger than some people may give it credit for. So it was called the CBP app. That just stands for Customs Border and Control. And it was a government app used by migrants for which they would submit their information and they would schedule appointments for border entry. And that is no longer available. That means that people who followed the rules and did things right now have no legal repercussion. Their appointments have been canceled. There's no legal pathway to citizenship. Now, in actuality, that applies only to people who are not citizens. But in a more message sending kind of way, symbolic type of way, it shows that President Trump is willing to circumvent protocols, circumvent rules to get what he wants. And the fact that he went as far as to sign this executive order that ends birthright citizenship shows that. Birthright citizenship is guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. But he is going to literally challenge the Constitution and do so through the courts in order to try to get this done. It just shows his nature to circumvent protocol. And that should be alarming even for legal migrants in this country.
And Tim, one of the other things that I mentioned there briefly is the idea of Trump's orders ending diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in federal government, yes. Having the government recognize only two sexes, rolling back protections for LGBTQ people. What are some of the practical effects of these moves?
Wow. And I'd say wow because the list of protections that are now gone now give states the right to literally legalize to some degree discrimination against certain populations, or to at least not make it illegal to discriminate against certain populations. When you look at he reversed the protections in governments for people of gender identity and people of different sexual orientations, when you look at the fact that he reversed several executive orders that were designed to increase economic opportunities for Black Americans, when you look at his also for Latin Americans and Hispanic Americans, when you look at these executive orders, these protections were put in place to prevent institutions and systems from discriminating against people. Now these people don't have these protections. And the rationale is not given that these protections that were put in place didn't cost federal and local governments any more money. It didn't require them to hire any more additional personnel. All of these protections were put in place within the existing infrastructure. So there is no rationale as to why these protections are no longer in place.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. Our subject for the hour today is the end of the Biden administration, the start of the Trump presidency. We're talking about this with Matthew Dalek, political historian and professor at George Washington University, and Timothy Lewis, professor at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. I want to share some more texts we got from listeners. You can still join us at 800-222-9455. Marlene in Urbana said, "How do I feel that the fleecing and gaslighting is now going to be happening at full blast, that we are now in the darkest ages of oligarchy, that his speech was a prime example of this gas bag of lies. I'm disappointed in the USA for choosing this person as president." We also got a message from someone going by C in Harvard, Illinois, that says, "I hope that the broken clock being right twice a day holds true and that some of the people and policies put in place have some positive action. What else can we do but hope that something good comes from this?" Some of you are also keeping at least a little sense of humor about this. John in Springfield replied to our text inquiry with just a GIF of Homer Simpson ringing a handbell while holding a sign that says "The end is near." 800-222-9455 if you want to join us on the program today. That's 800-222-9455. One last thing I want to talk about before we move on to some of the maybe the cabinet and then President Biden's legacy is the what we may see in the courts in the coming weeks and months. Courts were pretty instrumental in slowing, if not stopping, a number of things the Trump administration tried to do the first time around. But let's listen to a voicemail we got on this very subject.
I'm calling from Clinton, Iowa, and I'd like to point out that all of these conversations about how there will be legal challenges to the things that Trump is saying and doing. Well, court decisions only matter if you care about the law and you plan on following the results of adjudication under that law. And I think you can pretty easily see that when you're committing treason yourself and pardoning other people who committed treason on your behalf, that you have somebody who doesn't care at all about the rule of law.
All right. Thank you for that voicemail. Matt, how are you thinking about this? And I don't know, in this new hyper litigious area for media, maybe we should say people were convicted of various forms of insurrection. Treason is something else that's working with a foreign government. But mm-hmm. but to the broader point about, you know, legal challenges work. We even heard J.D. Vance invoke, was it President Jackson who's, you know, the Supreme Court's made their decision. Now let them enforce it.
Yeah. Well, I think the caller raises a really profound question about the next 4 years, which is, I mean, Trump has shown a contempt for not only rules and protocols, but also for the law. I mean, even if you think, you know, he was being unfairly targeted in some of these investigations, you know, he refused to give back the national security documents he had taken after his first term. He clearly, you know, didn't care a fig about the laws governing the election, the presidential election in 2020, and urged the Georgia Secretary of State to find him, you know, 12,000 plus votes to overturn the election. And so then the question becomes, Trump, who is emboldened, who feels like he's learned from the mistakes of his first term. Will he follow, and will his team follow? And his team is also much more loyal to him personally and politically than they were in the first term. Will they agree to abide by the rulings of the federal courts? I don't know the answer to that, obviously. I don't know, you know, if J.D. Vance, I don't know what it would look like. You could see it's a path for a constitutional crisis, right? If even to the Supreme Court, which is friendly to Trump, but let's say they rule against him and Vance and Trump say, hey, we're not going to abide by that. Forget it. You know, then you do have a crisis on your hands. So, you know, there is a risk of a kind of rampant lawlessness that we're facing. And certainly, you know, Kash Patel, the Trump's nominee to be the FBI director, someone who has, I mean, giving political rally speeches unheard of for an FBI, incoming FBI director, promising to lock up Trump's enemies. You know, this is, this I think is one of the more perilous areas that the country is in and faces for the next few years.
Yeah, and you mentioned the top secret documents, and one of the other things that may have flown under some people's radar yesterday is a memorandum that Trump issued to the White House counsel that is basically giving a 6-month pass to people to get top secret / sensitive compartmented information security clearances without going through the normal vetting process. Apparently, people couldn't even access the White House facilities necessarily without these clearances. But just yet another way in which standard procedures are being done differently now. I guess we'll say it that way. 800-222-9455. If you want to join us today, we're going to take another break. My guests for this conversation about the first 24 hours of the Trump administration are Matthew Dalek, who's a professor in the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, also the author of multiple books, including most recently Birchers, How the John Birch Society Radicalized the American Right. And we're also joined by Timothy Lewis, an associate professor of political science at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. Again, if you want to join us, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. More to come after a break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. All this hour, we're talking about the beginning of the second Trump administration, some of the actions he's already taken back in office. And we are also going to be reflecting on President Joe Biden's legacy. My guests are Timothy Lewis, professor at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville, and Matthew Dalek, political historian and professor at George Washington University. One of the people we heard from recently was a listener named Jake, in West Frankfort, who said, "This show seems to get further away from covering topics about Illinois every day. It's turned into a politics show. True discussions of Illinois are rarely discussed. I think there are enough platforms that cover politics already. Have been a listener since your first broadcast on WSIU, but if it continues as a political format, I will not." Jake, thanks for the feedback. I appreciate that. And look, this is an interesting time we are living through, and we do try to keep our focus on Illinois, but there are some things that I think we just cannot look away from. 800-222-9455 is the number if you want to join us today. 800-222-9455. And let's go now to the phones. Sarah is calling from Champaign on line one. Sarah, thank you for calling in.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking my call. I am terrified. I'm 76 years old. I have never been so frightened about who was in power in this country. It seems that if you have enough money and if you're willing to back a lunatic, that you are welcome at the White House. And I would say to everyone who voted for Trump, shame on you.
Sarah, thank you for calling in. We also have a call from Scott in Burlington on line two. Scott, thank you for calling in.
Thank you. I'm just calling in to reiterate what I read in The Atlantic. It took Hitler 53 days to dismantle democracy in Germany, and I'm wondering how long people think Trump's going to take to do it. And additionally, now that there is no law at all for anybody that is associated with Trump and the Republicans, that there's going to be tens of thousands of brown-shirted goons out there doing whatever they want, raping, pillaging, murdering, intimidating, who knows what. And they think that they're going to be pardoned after they get rid of his political enemies. And he'll either send them out to do it directly and deny it, or they'll just do it on their own, figuring they can get away with anything. This is the death of democracy. The Supreme Court was bought with Citizens United in 2010, and then again in 2012 with McCutcheon versus the FEC. Unlimited, untraceable, dark money that is not taxable into our political system. There couldn't be any greater threat to democracy.
All right, Scott, thank you for calling in and sharing your perspective. I appreciate that. Matthew Dalek, how do you respond? And I guess because you've brought up a couple of times now this pardon of the insurrectionists or rioters at the Capitol. Some of them were just misdemeanor people who sort of, quote unquote, wandered in. Other of them were convicted of attacking police officers with sticks and flagpoles and bear spray and things like that. How are you thinking about that, about not only, you know, what it says about recent history and how Trump is trying to rewrite the history of what happened on January 6th, but also about this potential for sending a message that political violence is acceptable and maybe to be encouraged in the future?
Yeah, well, I would make a couple of points. One is that, you know, pardoning the 1600 January 6th rioters is consistent with Trump's rhetoric over the past really decade, where he has often celebrated political violence. He has, he made fun, I think, of the hammer attack on Paul Pelosi, husband to former Speaker Nancy Pelosi. He's rhapsodized about police officers roughing up suspects. He's bragged about trying to punch people, right? I mean, he's really kind of celebrated it. This is a more consequential action, of course, but it is condoning, not just political violence, but actually violence against police officers, which you know, back 30, 40, 50 years ago, the Republican Party would have said that's like the worst thing you can do.
Or 5 years ago, I would say.
Yeah, or maybe four or five. The other point though I want to make is just picking up on the caller's points. I think it's they're making really important points because, the second Trump term raises a kind of fundamental question about the present and future of American democracy. The guardrails, by most accounts, have been diminished. What is going to stop Trump from asserting his authority? And Joe Biden, who ran in part in 2020, 2022, and then again in 2024, and then Harris did as well, at least in part, on defending democracy, saving democracy, lost to Trump. And so the other thing that they raise is that, look, Trump believes he has a mandate. He is moving very aggressively. He didn't win the popular vote by very much. He did win it, but it was by maybe a point and a half. And, he runs real risk politically in a lot of what he does. And there's a real chance that he is going to overstep in a number of realms. And unless he, does what he was elected to do in terms of inflation and immigration, he could become unpopular pretty quickly, which is a challenge that he faces.
You mentioned President Joe Biden, former President Joe Biden there, and I that reminds me of a text we got from Jane in Pawnee, who said, "I will remember Joe Biden as the Herbert Hoover of the Democratic Party, a well-intentioned but feckless leader whose pride led to an abortive second campaign and a flawed, foreshortened attempt to elect Vice President Harris instead. Biden's legacy is a second Trump presidency." Let's get another call in now. Sarah is calling from Chicago. Sarah, thank you for calling in.
Hello. It's like, I know a lot of people voted for Trump because they thought he'd do like better with the economy, but I don't think most people realize that the president really doesn't have all that much control over economy, and the reason why things are bad right now is partially because of world events like the Ukraine war. And there are certain domestic themes like trouble with getting enough people to actually do construction jobs in order to build more houses and stuff like that. But
All right, Sarah, thank you. Thank you so much for calling in to share your perspective. I appreciate that. We're coming toward the end of our time together, just maybe 5-6 minutes left in the show. Tim, let me ask you, when you think back on former President Joe Biden's legacy, how are you going to think about it?
I'm going to speak as a political historian here, not to take anything away from Matt, but history is always more favorable of presidents than their current public opinion is when they leave office. So when the historians write the narrative, they always write it more positively than the actual electorate saw it when that individual left office. For example, George W. Bush had dismally low approval ratings when he left office, barely 30%. But when we think of the Bush presidency now, we often think of him as the great uniter who pulled the nation together after the terrorist attacks of September the 11th. So while former President Biden is leaving the office with somewhat low approval numbers and lower than other Democratic presidents like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, he will likely be seen favorably by presidential historians as a pro-labor president, probably the most pro-labor of the modern history. He made historic investments in the U.S. infrastructure, and he used his presidential pen or his executive orders to protect the most vulnerable populations in America, people of color, people of different sexual orientations, the disabled, those kind of people. Now, when you contrast that to Donald Trump, you literally see night and day. Donald Trump, in this second term, he will be the first president who's ever been elected that was impeached twice. He will be the first president who's ever a convicted felon. he breaks the rules and he does so proudly. And I think that does a significant damage to this notion of the moral president. The notion of the moral president is a concept that presidents are not only the leaders of the executive branch, but they are cultural role models, that they have virtues exemplified by their thoughts, their behaviors, their speech that can be mimicked by young Americans across the country. And I don't see that as anything that will be favorable when looking at President Trump.
One more caller before we end the hour. Don is calling from Champaign. Don, thank you for calling in.
Thank you. I'm listening to the people talking on the show, and they just seem oblivious to me. Somebody's going to look better in the future. No, people don't think about George Bush that way. They only think about that in the context of how awful things are now. This is the death of democracy. Who cares if he's politically unpopular? The Supreme Court has already said that he can do whatever he wants, and there are no legal issues with it. He can do whatever he wants. He's going to send his people out to kill people. He's going to take over. There are no more free or fair elections, and nothing anybody is going to be able to do about it since they bought and sold the Supreme Court.
All right, Don, thank you for that message. Tim, I'll give you a chance to respond to that. I will say I have struggled to sort of think of this in historic context. I did not live through the 60s and the early 70s. I was born in the mid 70s, but that was a dark and difficult time in American history, from assassinations of presidents and presidential candidates and figures like Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders, and we had bombings and mass protests and police officers beating young people in the streets. And yet, and we came through that and emerged into some, sort of reasonable time of peace and prosperity. And now we're facing these dark times again. How are you thinking about the future of American democracy and, through the lens of history and where we may be going?
If I may be frank, you have to think about it from your particular perspective. You mentioned the 1960s. For most Black Americans, this is a repeat of history that they've survived. You had the progress of the 1960s and 70s, and you had the conservative reclamation of the 1980s. But this is somewhat a repeat. If you're talking to a person who identifies as a woman, women have been in these cycles of gaining rights, losing rights, gaining access, losing access for years. So this is not new to the American experiment. What is new is how it is being done. And usually this type of dark backlash to progress doesn't come from the office of the president. And so that's what makes this uniquely different. And then I do think it's important to keep historical context and perspective. The average voter may now be thinking about the price of eggs, and that may matter to them currently, but that's honestly how Donald Trump got into office. We were thinking about singular issues absent context, and we voted for someone who may very well try to be a tyrant.
And Matt Dalek, just about a minute left. Final thoughts on where America is going and what lessons of history may have for us. How are you thinking about it? Yeah.
Well, to try to end on a slightly optimistic note, I think, you make a really profound, a great point, which is that, the United States, two things. The United States in the 1960s and 70s, most recently, experienced, I think, a lot more violence, political violence than we are today. The war in Vietnam was horrific. And the country was arguably as, if not even more divided than it is now. That's not to, say, hey, everything is fine now. But the other thing is that the United States has only been a truly multiracial democracy for about 60 years, right? Since the Voting Rights and Civil Rights Act. So it's still young. And that democracy has emerged, I think, in a much more fragile way over the past decade, especially since January 6th. But the next 4 years are going to help, I think, determine what that democracy looks like going forward in the 21st century.
Matthew Dalek of George Washington University, author of Birchers, How the John Birch Society Radicalized the American Right, and Timothy Lewis of Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. Thank you both so much for being with us today. Coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation with Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. I'm actually speaking with him this afternoon, so if you have questions you want me to ask, talk@21stshow.org is the address. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again tomorrow.